how to open a milk carton. Now, you know, a milk carton is not a naturally intuitive package. Like, it's not obvious the first time you see a milk carton how you're supposed to open the thing. Do you remember the first time you encountered a milk carton? Well, I bet you did what I did. That is, you manhandled the top apart until all the sides stood up, so you had a big square opening, and then you poured out of one of the corners. In fact, some people still open them that way. Lessons later. But somewhere along the way I was shown, or I worked out, that if you folded one side back, the side opposite the side that says open the other side, if you fold it back and squeeze, the top pops open and this neat little pouring spout emerges. How clever. Now this got me thinking, how many things in life have I learnt or experienced that shape who I am today? And maybe I'm not even aware, A, that I learnt them, or B, that they shape who I am today. For example, thinking about milk, many of us learned how to open a milk bottle. Now, if anyone born after 1980 won't have this skill, milk bottles were sealed with a little soft cap, and the bottle was designed with a little groove around the top into which this little cap was pressed. And there were four little raised bits in this groove that served a particular purpose. Now, there are two approved ways of opening a milk bottle cap. The first is the blokey method. The blokey method consists of a deft push of the thumb into the middle of the soft metal cap, and this has the effect of releasing the cap from the groove, and you can lift the whole lot off. However, the second method, which is generally considered superior because it was taught us by our mothers, allows us to put the cap back on the milk bottle when it goes in the fridge, whereas the blokey method tends to destroy the milk bottle cap. Now, mother's method was to place hand flat on top of the milk bottle, press down and rotate like this, so that those little grooves, those little raised portions in the groove, had the effect of releasing the milk bottle cap from the top, and you could take the whole thing off very neatly, and then when you poured something out, you could put it back on when you put it in the fridge again. Okay, let's do a quick poll. Who used to use the blokey method? Yes, not just blokes, you notice. Okay, who used to use mother's method? And who relied on the parrots? Those of you who don't understand that joke can talk about it later. Okay, now, why is this important? It's not. There's something important about it because it's a small example of the sorts of things we learn and we don't think much about. And that's important, that we learn a lot of stuff that we don't think much about. Because God is working in our lives from days before we are born to shape us into the kinds of people he wants us to be. God's shaping us for the plan that he has for our lives. God's at work in our lives, from our first day, then every day, shaping us for the service he has in mind, and most of the time, we don't even notice. When I was an undergraduate student at the University of Queensland, I concentrated on journalism and English. And in my last semester, I just had to get one half subject extra to complete the requirements for the degree. And I looked at the lecture timetable and I noticed that I had a spare hour between my fourth year major subjects, the journalism major and the English major, and there was this 1 hour gap between the two. So with great attention to the subject matter, not at all, I selected a subject that was actually being taught in that hour. I didn't care what it was, I just needed the half point and I get my degree. Now that subject was called Sociology of Revolutionary Movements. Now I wasn't much interested in sociology at that time, and I was even less interested in revolutionary movements. I thought revolutionary movements was what happened to you after a bad curry. But actually, I found the sociology of revolutionary movements quite an interesting topic, rather more interesting than I'd predicted. But I saw no use for the subject. After all, I was a radio announcer at the time. And I was interested in writing and journalism because they were relevant to my work, but how would the sociology of revolutionary movements be useful to me? Well, 2 years later, I found myself led to apply for a communication position at World Vision. They were looking for a journalist with media experience, and I was qualified. Soon I was trying to understand what World Vision was doing. What does it mean to be poor? What are the things that cause poverty? How do people respond to their poverty? And to my very great surprise, I found myself going back to the sociology subject, this little half subject that I'd studied, looking up the books I'd read and discovering that the things that they were saying to me were now suddenly central and important to my growing understanding of my new work. And I remembered thinking at the time, how clever is God, eh? How clever is he? I didn't even know that I'd need this subject, and he did. And not only that, he made sure there was this little hole in my lecture program where it fitted perfectly. Without even knowing, God was shaping me for the work he wanted for me. God was at work. He was shaping me for service. Now, we've been looking at this book, it seems like forever, Ken, this terrific book by Rick Warren, The Purpose-Driven Life. And right at the beginning of this book, Rick Warren asks, why on earth am I here for? Why on earth am I here for? And his answer is, we're here for five things. We're created by God to fulfill five purposes. And these are, first, to enjoy God and for him to enjoy us. Secondly, to live as part of God's family. Thirdly, to become like Jesus. Fourthly, to serve God. And fifthly, for mission. And already we've heard Ken and Brian and Peter and me talk about these first three, enjoying God and God enjoying us, being part of God's family, and becoming like Jesus. And today and next week, Ken and I are going to talk about this fourth one, to serve God. We're going to talk about the way that God is shaping us for service. And the first thing to say is that we are created for work. Now, this is something that Christians can easily overlook, because there's no doubt that we are saved by grace and not by works. Our place in the kingdom is not dependent on anything that we do. Our relationship with Jesus is not determined by our work. And Paul makes this clear. Can we have a look at the Ephesians verses? Paul makes this clear when he writes to the Christians in Ephesus. Here, there. He says, for it is by grace that you've been saved, through faith, and this is not from yourselves, it's the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. Very clear. Our salvation is a gift of grace. Amazing grace, no doubt. Unworthy grace, no doubt. And we are saved through faith, only faith. Works has nothing to do with it. But wait, there's more. Verse 10 says, for we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do. How many times have you heard someone quote the first two verses and not the third one? People quote to us these first two verses about the importance that our salvation comes through grace, but overlook the fact that immediately Paul makes this very significant and important qualification. Yes, we are saved by grace and through faith, but we are created to do good works. But it's even better than that, because Paul says we are God's workmanship. We are made by God. And he made us, how? To do good works. And he prepared in advance those good works for us to do. God was at work on us even before we were born. He said to the prophet Jeremiah, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. Just as God had a plan for Jeremiah even before he was a fetus, God has a plan for you and for me before our own beginning. We are his workmanship. We are his workmanship, created for good works that he prepared in advance for us to do. Now, I can't avoid a little aside here, because there's actually something deficient in the English language. This little word, do, right at the end, misses some of the poetry of the Greek language and some of the nuances that the Christians in Ephesus would have understood when Paul was writing to them. Maybe you've heard the English word peripatetic. It means to walk about. Peripatetic. And this word, peripatetic, to walk about, is the word, or the Greek equivalent is the word, only Steve can pronounce it properly, that Paul uses here, and that we just simply translate do. Paul uses the original Greek word at the end of verse 10. And he says, what he says is literally, is that God prepared these good works in advance for us to walk around doing. For us to walk around doing. Now, the reason that he uses this word is that 200 years before Jesus, before Paul, there was a very famous Greek philosopher whose name was Aristotle. And he was famous for the way he talked. He was famous for the fact that he walked up and down when he talked. He taught in the Lyceum in Athens, and he would walk backwards and forwards, and he walked down into his students and so on. And he became famous for this method of teaching by walking around. And the Greek word, of course, was this word that we use, that we know in English, peripatetic. So soon enough, this idea of walking around was used to describe anyone who demonstrated their works in action. So every time this word was used in a context like this, it meant that someone who lived out their beliefs, who lived them out in action, was described as doing it peripatetically, doing it by walking around. And they would think of Aristotle as soon as they saw this word, and they would have this picture in their mind of Aristotle and his ideas striding out and being a very active teacher. So this verse 10 says, we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to walk around doing, to live out, not to do in any kind of shoulder-shrugging or lukewarm or half-hearted way, not carrying a grudge or not doing something just out of duty. Our work is intended to be full-on, whole-of-life stuff. Throw yourself into it fully. Get out there. Walk around. Show people that we're created for good works. Obvious, visible good works, just as Aristotle strode up and down, the perfect example of the enthusiastic, wholehearted teacher, we're shaped by God in advance to throw ourselves into active and obvious good works. When Christians are at work, the world should see movement. So we're saved by grace, but we're saved for good works. This is what Paul says, and you can't say half of it and have the whole gospel. Thanks, David. Now, don't worry about it, because God doesn't just throw us out into the world and say, do good works. God gives us everything we need to fulfill the plan he has for us. If God wants us to do something, you can be sure that he equips us fully to do it right. God shapes us for serving him. And how does God shape us for service? Well, here Rick does a very clever thing. He gives us a memory aid, a mnemonic. He takes the word shape, S-H-A-P-E, and he applies a word to each of those letters. So it goes like this. Here is how God shapes us for ministry. First of all, S stands for spiritual gifts. H stands for heart. A stands for abilities. P stands for personality. And E stands for experience. What good works are we shaped for? It'll be some kind of work that uses our S, spiritual gifts. It'll be some kind of work that for which we have a heart, H, a heart, a passion. It'll be something that we really can throw ourselves into and enjoy. Thirdly, God will have good works designed for us that use our abilities. For sure, God's not going to give us some work to do unless we're able to do it. Fourthly, God will use our P, personality. It'll be a kind of work that will suit our personality. And then God will give us good works that use our E, experience. So spiritual gifts, heart, abilities, personality and experience. This is the way that God shapes us for service. And if you're saying to yourself, well, I'm not sure what service God is shaping me for at the moment, think about those five things. Draw them together and I'm sure you'll find there's a match between your spiritual gifts, the things which you have a heart or a passion, your abilities, your personality and your experience. There'll be some kind of good works that for which you are being fitted or have been fitted. I was born in Parramatta in New South Wales, about three blocks from where my convict forebear, Richard, once had a saddler's business. Now, I love that song that Peter Allen wrote, Tenderfield Saddler. Some of you will know that. Some of you will know Peter Allen, I suppose. I love that song because it's really the story of my convict forebear, even though he was in Parramatta and Peter Allen's forebear was in Tenderfield. That was aside. I didn't need to tell you that. John Morris Hunt was my father. He was an engineer. But much of our life as a family was centred around the Granville Methodist Church, where my dad was the Sunday school superintendent. My mother was one of the organists. And every child, I thought my experience of church was everybody's experience, or my experience of life was everybody's experience. Being a Christian for me was the most natural thing in the world. Of course, I went to school and I discovered there were people with different experiences of church and of many other things, and those experiences were a bit different to mine. Some other kids went to church, but they went to different ones. And if there were any Jews or Muslims, they weren't at my school in the 50s. Or if they were, the teachers just made them line up with the Anglicans in those days. If you weren't something, you weren't a Catholic, and you didn't nominate another Protestant religion, you were instantly Church of England. True. Anyway, I was serious about my religion because my family was, and like all, I accepted the way my family behaved as if it were absolute, which was the way of the world as far as most of us in the baby boomer generation was concerned. Then Billy Graham came to town, and I don't remember too much about his crusades except that in my case it was at the Sydney Showgrounds and that they were huge. But I do remember that I followed the crowd one night down to the front to give my life to Jesus. Was I following the herd instinct? Well, probably. Did I understand what I was doing? Well, I thought I did. Did I expect my life to be different after that? Yes, frankly, I did. And was it? No. It was the same life, the same problems, the same struggles, the same. In fact, I wasn't yet a teenager, so it was bound to get worse. But one thing was certain, I did want to do it. And I did say a prayer something like this one: Jesus, I want you to be my guide for the rest of my life. I want to do whatever you want me to do. And I think I meant it. So what happened? Well, I went to school. My dad got promoted to be Queensland manager, and when I was 15, we all moved to Brisbane. Both my parents were musical. I learned to play the piano and the pipe organ. One of my mates had a ukulele, so I borrowed it, and I learned to play it in one afternoon. And then I spent a whole pound to buy one ukulele of my own. And then Dad bought me a guitar for my birthday. Well, folk music was big in the 60s, and it was much more interesting than schoolwork. So I formed a trio, and we did gigs all over southeast Queensland pretending to be the Kingston Trio. Now, about this time, I hit year 12, or rather it hit me, and I failed. And suddenly, I had no idea what I was going to do. So my immediate remedy was to suggest to the family that I go jackarooing. Now, my parents saw that jackarooing was an occupation for which I was immensely not gifted, and they sent me back to school to repeat year 12. Slowly, the idea formed in my head that I was to be a doctor. God knows why. No, actually, God knew something else altogether different. I can imagine God saying, Philip, a doctor? I don't think so. Anyway, I had another great year at school, debated, I won the public speaking competition. I took the role of the captain in HMS Pinafore, and a very fine captain too. I crammed to do the entire secondary school, secondary level music course in 1 year and managed to pass. I took leadership roles in Methodist camps all over the state every school holidays. But I didn't study chemistry. But also I played in the 6th rugby union side. There were only 6 sides. And only one other school, Nudgee College, actually had enough boys to field 6 teams. So we only played one game for the whole year. And Nudgee College won 76-0. But I didn't study chemistry. And I failed chemistry at the end of the year. And in those days, you needed chemistry to do medicine. Now what? Well, Dad took me along to the National Bank and he held my hand while I applied to be a bank johnny. And I enjoyed just over a year in the bank, but my real life was happening elsewhere. My trio was busy every weekend. I was comparing at discos. I was helping to stage monthly youth rallies, not to mention driving across Brisbane regularly to visit a very interesting female folk singer named Judy, who was proving to be everything I dreamt about in a girlfriend. Somewhere in the midst of this, the manager of one of the Brisbane radio stations got to know me, and one day he said, if you ever want to be in radio, let me know. Did I want to be in radio? Now that sounded like fun. I reckon about this time I started to move from learning to unlearning. I remember my surprise at how really unprofessional much of radio and television was in those days. Somehow the slickness of the finished product and the enthusiasm of the voices and the faces of media people had taught me something, or at least I thought I'd learned, that the media was about doing your best, about high production values, about art, about sincerity. But as I worked in the media, I had to unlearn a lot of this, and I found it was full of people who led double lives, on air and off air. Their sincerity was entirely manufactured. What sounded like a good performance or a good show was the result of shortcuts, deceptions, and a lot of cut and paste. In 1976, I got the first real inkling that maybe God had taken seriously the prayer of a boy prayed at the Billy Graham Crusade. I'd said I wanted him to guide me, that I wanted to do with my life what he wanted. It happened like this. I was reading the trade magazine, Broadcasting and Television Weekly, and there was a job ad, not for a radio job, but for a charity job. Now, World Vision was advertising for a communicator. One thing impressed me about their ad, and a second thing just blew me away. The thing that impressed me about the ad was that a charity had the unusual good sense to advertise in this particular magazine. If they wanted an experienced media person, this was the ideal place to advertise. And yet, I'd never before seen a non-media organisation advertise in this magazine. Clearly, whatever this World Vision organisation was, they seemed to know their business. But the thing that blew me away was that the ad read like a summary of my experience. It was my CV in print. Every one of the things they wanted, I'd done. I took the ad home and showed it to Judy, and we agreed I should apply. It was just as if I'd been shaped to fulfil this role. Now, isn't that surprising? Well, to cut a long story short, I got the job as one of two communications officers, and I thought that maybe this was all part of some divine plan, that maybe my childish prayer had been carefully considered by a power higher than I could imagine, that someone up there really did have a plan for me. Those first 6 years with World Vision were really exciting. We introduced the 40-hour famine, and then we turned it into a national success. We got onto television for the first time. You see the fruits of that just recently. We developed a direct marketing strategy. World Vision soon enough became a household name. Well, after this, there were many and regular examples of how God was shaping me and then inviting me into ways of serving him that I hadn't planned, but that I realised he had uniquely planned and equipped for. Judy and I were both surprised to be asked to go to Hong Kong in the 1980s to develop a World Vision ministry in Hong Kong and Singapore. And then I was invited to lead World Vision Australia, and after a number of years, to go to Europe and lead World Vision's ministry in the regions of Middle East and Eastern Europe. Every time that happened, it was a surprise, and yet it was clear that God was at work. Later, we felt called to return to Australia for reasons of Richard's education, nothing to do with career. But God had this in mind too, and he led me through an interesting and actually quite enjoyable time of redirection and rethinking about what it was I was to do. And 2 years ago, I know God led me to Deakin and the Student Association, where these days much of my experience is being focused and freed in a new way of serving him. And then one other story. God led me into radio and God led me out of radio. And while I was working at World Vision Australia about 15 years ago, a radio station licence here in Melbourne came up for sale. And a World Vision colleague and I expressed our dream for there to be a Christian radio station in Melbourne. We had this vision, a vision of a radio station that would speak to the whole Melbourne community, that would be for Christians and non-Christians. Not radio for Christians, but radio by Christians. Radio that operated from Christian values. We wrote a business plan. We took it to some people that had money, but we couldn't raise the finance and the idea died. Or so it seemed to me. Well, 2 years ago, I was invited to join the board of Light FM, and I discovered that my dream had not died. It had been God's dream all along, and he'd kept it alive through many others. These days I'm vice chairman of Light FM, and through my involvement I'm discovering all over again how God has shaped me for that role. What a great privilege to be a servant of a master who shapes us for the very service to which he calls us. Okay, why do I have this journey to talk about? Is it because I'm a good Christian? Well, of course, that's the reason, yes, that's it. No, many others pray better than I do. Many others are more spiritual. Many others are more devotional. Many others are less sinful. Frankly, I reckon this journey has got nothing to do with my faithfulness, as we sang before. It's all about Jesus. It has to do with God and his faithfulness. And as I look back, I see so much evidence of a higher power that shaped a child, shaped a man, and who still today shapes and leads me into the work to which he calls me. May it be so for you too. Amen.